I spent last weekend in Chicago, and we discussed one topic in four different ways. That was fun. Mm-hmm. And the topic was, how does boxing begin? Because if you can understand how bhakti begins, it gives a clue about how to make the problem. Same way, it turns out, is how it begins. And then it's like a nice question of what's bhakti anyways? And what's the seed of bhakti? Hey!
Sorry, I'm late.
You're right in the beginning. You missed the kirtan. I'll just do a few things that maybe will like stir your thoughts, and then we'll go from there. There's a... Anybody here not know who is Lord Chaitanya? Anyone not know who is Lord Chaitanya? Okay. Okay. His picture is right here, in the middle. That's Lord Chaitanya with his arms raised like this, with golden dhoti. And he's the inaugurator of what we just did, the singing together. Kirtan means singing, and Sankirtan means together, singing together, singing names of God. So, Lord Chaitanya established that. It was already in the scriptures, but he took it and developed in the association of other devotees of Krishna. They, in like we're doing, a little place, they chanted, and they chanted, and they chanted, and they chanted all night. It became a regular... They go to work the next day and chant all night, and go to work the next day and chant all night. It was ecstatic chanting. And it became so ecstatic that it left the private place and went into the public places, into the marketplaces. Then it was a village, so it was marketplaces. And then from the marketplaces it went all around the district, and from the district it went to Jagannath Puri, and then it went to South India and all over India. So he established, based on the teachings of this nice set of books called Srimad Bhagavatam, based on the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam, a life of devotion to Krishna that has as its basis or foundation the chanting of the holy name, awakening the dormant attraction for Krishna that's within the heart of every living being. Because those books teach that, and Bhagavad Gita also teaches, that every living being is a tiny, fragmental spark of a big, blazing fire. The big, blazing metaphor. The big, blazing fire is the source of everything, and the spark is the tiny spiritual particle that's part of that spiritual source of everything. So all things material and all things spiritual have a common source of emanation, and that, according to Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, that happens to be Krishna, also known by so many other names, millions of other names. It's not a different... there's not multiple supremes. There's not multiple sources of everything. By different names, that supreme source of everything is addressed, but it's the one same source. And all living entities are part of that supreme. And within the heart of every living entity, whether it's not just the human form of life, all species also have a soul within them, animating, and the soul has attraction for that source, for Krishna, love for Krishna. There's a verse, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhya Kabunoi. Shravanadi, Shravana means hearing, Shravanadi beginning with hearing, Shuddha Chitte, one's consciousness becomes purified or cleansed by hearing spiritual sound vibration. And by that hearing of spiritual sound vibration, as one becomes purified, that dormant Krishna prema. Prema is a very special word. It means spiritual love or divine love. Not the other kind. You know, the romance kind. It's the divine love kind. What's that? Oh. What is it? Okay. When you do that, it gets a little hot in here. The temperature's ramped up. I'm feeling a little hot when you have to leave that door closed for a while. Well, either way, turn the temperature down and leave the door open. Still a little hot. Okay, so the picture I wanted to share is inside everything that's living, whether regardless of species, there's a soul within. The soul is animating matter. When the soul leaves that covering, that's called death, and the elements disintegrate. Soul is the integrating and animating factor. And within that soul, the teachings of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, so Lord Chaitanya was teaching, everyone has this natural attraction for Krishna, and by calling and praising and singing his name, then that dormant attraction for him awakens. And so he came to deliver that process. In Sanskrit, it's called the Yuga Dharma. Those of you from India, you know what that means. But it's the primary means for this yuga, or this age, for advancing towards spiritual perfection, awakening the highest possible stage of consciousness of the living being. That's what Srimad Bhagavatam teaches. And then Lord Chaitanya came to deliver it and live it and attract others to that process. And then he gave teachings of the whole lifestyle that goes along with it. How do you live a life of devotion? So the topic that I was speaking about was, how does it all begin? So there's Lord Chaitanya taught two very principal associates who later became the authors of many books, because Lord Chaitanya asked them. He didn't write books. He gave the teachings and empowered them to realize the message, and then empowered them to write literatures that expanded on that message based on Srimad Bhagavatam, which they did. So I'll just say two things about what Lord... So when Lord Chaitanya spoke to Rupa Goswami, some of you know who is Rupa Goswami, and others of you, if you don't know who is Lord Chaitanya, you don't know who is Rupa Goswami. He's one of the principal associates. He lived in Vrindavan, where Krishna was born, or had his childhood pastimes. He lived in Vrindavan, and while living there, he lived like a mendicant, although previously he and his brother were prime minister and chief minister under the government of a Muslim king over what at that time was about a third of India, Nawab Hussein Shah, in the northeastern part, now Bengal and Orissa and parts of Bangladesh and all that area up there. They were the prime minister and chief minister, and their younger brother was the finance minister. They ran the government. They were good. But they weren't interested at all. They did that because the Muslim king, Nawab, he understood in order to rule here, I have to have the people who are largely Hindu be peaceful with Muslim rule. So he selected these three because they were very good at, they were leaders that people were respectful towards. So he met with them and he gave them a choice. He was very direct. He said, there's two choices. Either you assist me in my government, or I'll torture and kill all of the Hindus and the Vaishnavas in the land. Think about it. Let me know what your conclusion is. Of course, they didn't want to do either one. But they accepted the service of the king so that they could then protect the citizens and engage them in devotional activities and not be harassed by the king. The king was fine. He got the taxes. He could rule the people. They were peaceful. It was a good program. Except they weren't interested. And in course of time, they gave up their government service with opulence and palace and, you know, how people strive like anything to get a political position. They just walked away and went to live as mendicants in Vrindavan. Literally, they just had like one cloth and slept under a tree, different tree every night, and lived very simply. But their hearts were filled with devotion for Krishna that they had received from Lord Chaitanya, and they busied themselves in writing books for future generations like us to understand how to develop that devotion nicely, step by step by step. And in one biography of Lord Chaitanya's life, it records, it wasn't like a recording device, but the descriptions later were produced, that's like one generation later, just from sharing of conversations and notebooks and things like that. Kadachas, it's called. Diaries of persons that had interaction with Lord Chaitanya. So, it described in his talks with Lord with Rupa Goswami, one of those two brothers, Lord Chaitanya described something, this is my language, something like a pyramid. He described living entities that are, their existence is completely separate from matter, but somehow or other, the desire to enjoy matter, enjoy God's kingdom without God, became their aspiration. And so they received coverings or bodies in order to facilitate that separate enjoyment desire. And so there's so many species of life. It lists some of them. 8,400,000 of Vedic literature describes just species, different categories of living entities. And then amongst them, some, a small number, 400,000 out of 8,400,000 are human. So he just does the pyramid. And out of those that are human, some follow principles of Dharma or religion. And some just give lip service and don't really follow, but some then genuinely follow. And those that genuinely follow, commonly their interest is elevation to a higher heavenly realm of enjoyment, enjoying piously here, and attainment of heaven beyond, and this life. And amongst those, some are aspiring for salvation, or liberation, becoming freed from the cycle of birth and death. And out of those, very rare to find one who is not interested in liberation, but they're interested simply in serving the Supreme. And then he describes how that rare, out of the pyramid, how that comes to be, how it begins. So that's the topic. And there's a nice verse. I'll say it slowly. And those of you that stick around for a while, you'll hear this verse again and again. It's a very common verse. Brahmanda Brahmite Kona Bhagyavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasadi Bhai Bhakti Lata Bija. It's Bengali, but you know the meaning is easy. Brahmanda refers to the universe, this slice of the universe, the middle part of this universe. It's our universe, Brahmanda. Brahmanda, Brahmite, wandering throughout the universe. Living entities are wandering and wandering and wandering in different species of life, sojourning up and down and all around in searching for happiness in material existence. And out of them, one may become very fortunate. Bhagyavan is the word. Bhagyavan. So those of you that have read Bhagavad Gita, you know when Krishna speaks, it says Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. He's Bhagavan. He's the possessor of all opulences in full. And one who receives his mercy sounds similar, but it's Bhagyavan, fortunate. He received the mercy of Bhagavan, it's Bhagyavan. And Guru Krishna Prasade Bhai. So you all know what prasad means. They're preparing some in the kitchen now. That which is offered to Krishna, and then we receive his mercy, that's prasad. So, Guru Krishna Prasade Bhai Bhakti Lata Bija. So the thing I want to focus on is this Bhakti Lata Bija. Bija means seed, and Lata means creeper, and Bhakti means, as we said before, divine love. The seed of divine love, which grows like a creeper, is received by the combined mercy of Guru and Krishna. When Krishna sees, out of all these pyramid living entities, there's one amongst them who is thinking, gee, there's got to be something beyond all this. I mean, this is okay, but there's a reality that's beyond all this. I don't know exactly what it is, but I'm, in my heart of hearts, I know there's something more than all of this. And when that person unknowingly has some interaction with someone who's carrying bhakti in their heart, very important, because like the heart is like a vessel, and the bhakti that's within the heart is like liquid gold. And when someone who has received some of that bhakti that's like liquid gold bumps into someone else and spills a little bhakti on that somebody else, they get like bhaktiized. They get benefited, even unknowingly. And that's how bhakti begins. So, I'm just there's like so much to say. Like I said, I spoke four different parts, but it's nice to share. So I'll just take little pieces of those that the seed of the bhakti lata or the creeper of bhakti specifically is faith in. Devotional teaching or scriptures that reveal what that relationship with Krishna is. That's what our acharyas, our teachers following Lord Chaitanya describe, of course with reference to scripture. But so that faith is something very simple. It's Lord Chaitanya defined this also. It's confidence that if I can achieve one thing, other desirable things will follow. like many of you are here to do your studies, because if you get that one thing, the degree, then many other things that are going to be needed in your life will follow that. So you're consolidating and focusing on, I mean, you do other things, but extracurricular things and things, but it, you know, that's very important. Or, you know, the Olympics are coming up, so the people that are, you know, competitors in the Olympics, their whole life is focused on one thing: get the gold medal. And they subordinate everything to that one thing. You know, they don't have social time or just it, because everything is disciplining themselves and preparing for that. Or a businessman, get money. Everything, by hook or by crook, everything follows that one thing. And you know, they may want to do it by honest means. They don't, may not mind honest, dishonest. Just they say they have their values, but you know, it's get money, like that. So, by faith is by achieving something, other things desirable will follow that something. And Lord Chaitanya's teaching is bhakti, faith and devotion is confidence that if I can somehow awaken my attraction in loving service, somehow awaken that attraction for loving service to Krishna, then from that spiritual well-being, material well-being, and all other desirable things will follow. He gives that definition of faith. So the seed of that faith is how bhakti begins. And then Lord Chaitanya says that seed should be received like a gardener and plant it or sow it within the heart, and then water the seed by the process of hearing and chanting. Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu. Hearing and hearing spiritual sound vibrations like we're doing right now. You know, messages of Bhagavad Gita, messages of Srimad Bhagavatam, teachings of Lord Chaitanya, like that. And the holy name. That's the seed being watered or nurtured. And then this is just highlights of 8 hours of stuff. So when Lord Chaitanya similarly taught Sanatana Goswami, he used the same pyramid type of description, because it's true, there's all varieties of living entities, and some are human, and some are regulated, and some are aspiring for higher happiness, and some want devotion to God. And he said, and then he says, how that happens, out of that very rare group of persons, it happens through association with sadhu. Those of you from India, you know what that means. Holy men, or those who are attached to sat are sadhu. And sat means eternal reality, attached, and having taken shelter in, or even more specifically, those who are attached to the Supreme Person in His loving service, so an elevated devotee. That's how bhakti begins. And then he says, right after that, and in the highest of stages, that association of sadhu is equally important. It's how it begins. It's how it reaches its mature stage, and that means everything in between too. Just says it very succinctly. And then he makes reference to three different, to support the statement, he makes reference to three different teachings from Srimad Bhagavatam, where it illustrates or supports his statement. I'd like to describe quickly one of them. I mean, a quick one. It's a verse spoken in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. That means like Krishna's pastimes. There's the 10th canto. And it's chapter 51. It's King Muchukunda speaking to Krishna. It's, there's a longer version of the, like a kind of much shorter version, but the longer version is real nice. All the details are really nice. King Muchukunda was a contemporary of Krishna, but he was from a different dynasty. Krishna was from the Moon Dynasty, and he was from the Sun Dynasty. He is a descendant of Ikshvaku, those of you that know, from the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, the very first verse, Krishna says to Arjuna, long and long ago, I taught the same message to the sun god Vivaswan. Vivaswan taught it to his son, Manu, Vivaswata Manu. Manu taught it to his son, Ikshvaku, and in this way, the knowledge was passed on through disciplic succession. So Ikshvaku dynasty descended to earth, and the line of kings in his dynasty, Muchukunda was in that line. And he was a religious man. He was a little attached also. Religious people can also be attached to like power and position and da-da-da-da-da-da. But, you know, religious and a little attached. And a great fighter. Powerful. His reputation was, he's very powerful. So, although from different dynasties, he had the association of Garga Muni. Those of you that are a little familiar with this, Garga Muni was an astrologer that did the name-giving ceremony for Krishna and Balaram. Garga Muni. He was of the Yadu dynasty, and that was his, like his, he was really good. So he did the astrology chart for Muchukunda. And he said, oh, this is a very auspicious chart. You're going to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. Oh, really? Tell me. And then he described Krishna, his features, and his eye, you know, his dress, and his relationships with others, and his dazzling effulgence. He had never seen him. He was just giving him a description, like we might get a description of Krishna. But it moved his heart. And so from that point on, he was praying and praying to Krishna, please fulfill this. Please come. I don't know who you are, but please come before me, as Garga said would happen. And he was remembering the description of his form and his qualities and his activities. He was Krishna conscious, although he had never met Krishna, like us. We're trying to at least be Krishna conscious. And then something happened. Indra, king of heaven, had a problem. He was being attacked by the daityas. So he heard of the prowess of Muchukunda. So he came to see Muchukunda and asked him, please help. I'm just an earthly person. You're the heavenly. But you're good, so please come and help us. Some service, sure. So we went and assisted in the heavenly realms for a long time. Big, big fighting. And finally, Kartikeya came as the replacement of the chief general, and they said, thank you, Muchukunda. You can take a break now. Now we have Kartikeya here. And so we'd like to offer you a benediction. He said, well, I'm really tired. I'd like the benediction that I can sleep without being interrupted. And then he asked for an additional detail. He said, if anyone interrupts my sleep, from my eyes will come fire and they'll immediately burn to ashes. And the commentators say the reason he asked for that diabolical little twist was he thought maybe the demigods, maybe Indra will come and bother me again. I don't want to do this again. So just, you know, let me rest without being disturbed. Okay, we'll give you that benediction. So he returned to earth and he found a nice quiet cave. I saw it on a Google map. They have a place where you can see, you know, where the cave is. And it's some distance from then the capital of Mathura. Some of you may have been to Mathura. So he's sleeping in a cave. Then there's this other king who was he was really a mean person. He wanted to control the kingdom, so he put his father in jail. He put Vasudeva and Devaki, his sister and brother-in-law, in jail and took over the kingdom. And a prophecy was made that the eighth child of his sister, Devaki, would kill him. So he, one by one, killed each of the children that was born of her. He was not a nice man. And many other things. So Krishna was that eighth child of Devaki. And when Krishna was just 12 years old, he came to Mathura, and there was many things happened. But in the course of one part of the many things that happened, Krishna, with one punch, finished Kamsa. He was dead. Just a 12-year-old boy, this big, powerful, mighty hero. There was the scourge of the earth. Well, there's details, but he was very powerful. So Kamsa had two wives, two queens. The queens, there's lots of really nice detail, but the queens were daughters of another king, Jarasandha. And how that came to be is a nice story. How they became his... I'll tell the story, it's nice. Kamsa was off conquering kingdoms. And he would, like, smash the entire army and leave just the king remaining and give them the choice. You can either assist me or I'll kill you. Which would you like? Kind of, you know, they said, okay, we'll with you. So he was building up his power and consolidating others. So he was off somewhere doing that. And Jarasandha was another king, and he was practicing his prowess by going into the forest and jungles and hunting wild animals. And so he captured this huge, gigantic, big as 10 big elephants. Wild elephant. Captured him and chained him down on all four legs. And then was off looking for other tigers and whatever the wild things he could find. That elephant, when the great effort pulled the stakes out of the ground with the chain still attached to his leg, went running in a northerly direction. Just happened to go in the same direction where Kamsa had his camp. And when he reached the camp where Kamsa was, there was a battle. Kamsa was so powerful that Kamsa picked up the elephant and twirled him around and threw him several miles in the air and came crash landing on his head right at the camp of Jarasandha. When Jarasandha saw that, he went, wow, this guy's good. Whoever did this, I want to meet him. So he went to find out, and it was Kamsa, and he made it. He said, you're good. Let's work together. And you can keep the elephant as a gift, and here's my two daughters. You can marry them. So through alliance, you know, the two kingdoms became strong. So when Kamsa was killed by Krishna, the two wives went running to Jarasandha. Oh, daddy! This Krishna killed our husband. Do something. Take revenge. Right there, he took a vow. I will destroy not only Krishna, but his whole Yadu dynasty. And he gathered huge armies. So the girls were, yay, daddy. And he gathered huge armies. And he went charging to Mathura to challenge Krishna. The detail is really nice. Krishna then thought, I've appeared in this world at the request of Mother Earth and Lord Brahma, to annihilate demoniac kings. This is an opportunity to do that. Just he had the thought. And two celestial chariots just descended and appeared, filled with his transcendental weapons. And he smiled and looked at Balaram and said, "Let's go." So they both mounted a chariot, and off they went, just the two of them, in the midst of the huge phalanxes is the term. Many, 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 many soldiers and, you know, chariots and infantry and everything. Just the two of them, Krishna and Balaram, defeated everybody and left one person standing. Jarasandha. And Balaram immediately jumped off his chariot and started tying him up like a criminal. Take him back and put him in prison. And Krishna said, "No, let him go." And he was thinking, "I've come to relieve the earth of demoniac kings. Kamsa, when he goes back, he'll bring some other demoniac people and it'll help fulfill my purpose of coming. So let him go." So as Kamsa was going back, he was so ashamed, because Vedic culture says a king or anyone, once honored, dishonor is worse than death. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita like that. So Kamsa was thinking, Jarasandha was thinking, "I should just give up my life. What's the use? I've been shamed by this puny person, humiliated completely." And he was in that mood when he reached his palace, and the ministers were saying, "No, no, no, it's just one of those things. You know, sometimes it's this and sometimes it's that. You're powerful, and get another army together, get a bigger army, and go back and try it again. You'll win this time. Yay, Jarasandha." So he said, "Yeah, I'm powerful. I'll get another army and we'll go back and win." And that repeated itself 18 times. He didn't get the message. He just kept bringing many armies. And Krishna annihilated the armies and left Jarasandha to go home again. But the 19th time was different, because there was another another king whose name was Kaliyavana. And Kaliyavana's residence was somewhere geographically like in the area of Afghanistan. So he was such a powerful king and fighter that he couldn't find anybody equal to him. He was challenging this one and that one. They said, "No, you're too good, we can't." So Narada paid a visit. Narada Muni is an associate of Krishna. Muni means a sage or a great thinker, literally it means. A great thinker. But he was more than that. He was a very, very exceptional devotee. So he went to visit Kaliyavana for a purpose. And Kaliyavana received him very nicely. And he said, you've served me and received me nicely. Let me do something for you. Oh, I want to find somebody who's an equal match to me." Well, he said, "There's only one person that can match you, and that's Krishna." He said, "Very well, then I'll make Krishna my enemy." And it was purposeful, because Narada was trying to help Krishna fulfill his purpose of appearing. So somehow, there wasn't text messaging at that time, but somehow the message got back and forth between Kaliyavana and Jarasandha. They had a common enemy. So they made an alliance. And then they made a plan that they would attack Mathura at the same time. The two powerful kings with their massive armies. Forget the number that says, a huge number of soldiers. And Kaliyavana got there first. And then Jarasandha's army was coming shortly. You can hear the tension, the music and the drama, right, the movie. So Krishna turned to Balaram and said, "This could be very dangerous for the Yadu dynasty. I want to situate them in a safe place. You hold off the armies. I'll get Vishvakarma to construct the city of Dwarka, transfer everybody from Mathura to Dwarka, situate them, and then I'll come back and we'll do our fighting. So he did that. And Balaram held everybody off. Krishna came back, and Krishna said, now I'm ready to go out onto the battlefield. So Krishna went onto the battlefield, and Kalyavana had also not seen Krishna, as Mushukunda had not seen Krishna, but he heard a description from Narada. He's very effulgent. And he has a form like this. He has, you know, a hue, a bodily complexion, like a dark rain cloud. And his features are very beautiful. So when Krishna came onto the battlefield, that must be him. And so he started chasing after him. Because Krishna didn't have weapons, so he put his weapons down and started chasing after Krishna. And purposefully, Krishna kept just a step or two ahead of him, so he couldn't reach him. And Krishna ran. Now, one of the codes of warrior conduct is you don't run from battle. You stand and fight. But Krishna ran. So Kalyavana was calling him names. You coward! This isn't the codes of chivalry for a Kshatriya. Stand and fight! And Krishna kept running. So he started running faster, so Krishna ran faster. Just out of his reach. And he ran a long distance, right into the cave of Mushukunda. Because Krishna had a plan. All of this was a transcendental plan. So Krishna went into the cave, and Kalyavana thought, ha, I got him now. He can't get away from me now. He's in a cave. So he went into the cave, looking around, and he saw someone sleeping on the ground. Ha! He was tired, and now he's sleeping. So he went over and kicked him really hard, as hard as he could. And Mushukunda, it was Mushukunda. Mushukunda woke up and turned and saw him, and flames came from his eyes, and instantly Kalyavana was a pile of ashes. Just like that. And Mushukunda looked around, and he saw in the cave another personality, glowing and brilliant, although it was a dark cave. So he approached the person and said, who are you? I can see from your features, you must be a celestial being, or maybe a representative of God, or some special personality. Please tell me, who are you? And then Krishna spoke and said who he was. I'm the son of Vasudeva and Devaki, and have taken birth on earth at the request of earth and Lord Brahma to come and annihilate the demoniac kings here on earth, like that one, which you have assisted me very nicely. Thank you. And then Mushukunda, the light went on. Oh, you're that person. And he spoke first. He spoke words of humility, because that's naturally what enters in the heart of someone when they're before a great personality. He said, he described in many verses his material attachments. As a king, my life has been, you know, chasing the king carrot. He didn't use that language, but, you know, having a big army and a big throne and people coming and going here and going there, receiving great honor and pomp, and having to always conquer more kingdoms, and being a great heroic fighter and receiving praise and honor from everyone. But there was no happiness in any of that. And now I'm seeing you. And I can understand that your coming before me is because of the good fortune I had of meeting Garga. And so this is the key point here. Garga Muni was a devotee. And Garga Muni didn't, like, you know, give him so much teachings of spiritual life. He just told him about Krishna. and described Krishna's beauty and described Krishna's activities and said, one day you're very fortunate, you'll see Krishna face to face. And that's all it took. Because he was genuinely a very elevated individual, elevated soul. Because of the mercy of Krishna, because of the mercy of Garga, I've now received your mercy. So, mercy of Krishna flows through the agency of the mercy of the devotee of Krishna. Yes? Which Lord Chaitanya was saying to Sanatana Goswami, this is an example of how bhakti begins. You just somehow just happen to be in the right place. Just, you know, somehow or other. By providential arrangement, who knows? Causeless mercy. You just happen to be in the right place and somebody with bhakti spills some bhakti on you. Or they may even go out of their way to find, you know, somebody in the spiritual marketplace. Here's a message from Krishna. It's got your name on it. It's for you. Here's the message. Take Krishna's name and chant Krishna's name and become happy. Krishna wants that for you. See, he's got your name on it. This is for you. Like that. Someone who is compassionately extending Krishna's message to others. And when that happens, the mercy of Krishna flows. That's what Gargamuni, that's what Mushukunda said. Then the next, he says, and I not only you've come, but all that affinity for kingly stuff, it's gone. It's just mercy. I was chasing and chasing, and it's gone. How kind you are. And Krishna said, Mujukunda, I came because you prayed for so long. And very sincerely, you pleased me very much by your sincere prayer, and for that reason I've come. And he said, no, it's not because of my prayer, it's the mercy of Gargamuni. That's why I prayed, and that's why you came. Then Krishna said, I'd like to give you some benediction. Ask for anything that you like, and it's yours. And Mucchakunda, bless his heart, said, please don't ask me that question. Because my heart is so dirty. I'll want something mundane and material and entangling and foolish. I don't want any of those things. And he started listing some of the things he used to like. And I have one request. Please engage me birth after birth in your service. I just like to be in your service, always. And Krishna replied, I was just testing you. You said that all these things were gone. I was just testing you, and it's true. A devotee like you is very, very special, very dear to me. Yes, you will always be engaged in my service. I grant you that benediction. So, from the beginning, in the intermediate and in the advanced stages, this very valuable, the Sanskrit term is sadhu sangha. Sangha means association, like what we're doing. And sadhu means a devotee. Association of devotees. That's how bhakti begins. It's how bhakti grows. And it's how it goes and grows and grows and grows and reaches its ultimate stage of the stage of love of God. This last part, this word lata means creeper, and Lord Chaitanya described by that watering process, this is going back to Rupa Goswami now, the creeper grows and two leaves unfurl as the creeper grows, and then further leaves and further leaves, and the creeper continues to grow and grow, and it grows even beyond the heavenly region, beyond the layers of the universe, into the spiritual sky, and comes to rest at the feet of Krishna, producing flowers and then ultimately fruits of love of God. The creeper grows by taking shelter of something, like a tree or something, or you stick, like you people that know a little bit about gardening, there's some vines and you grow them by just placing trellises, and they grow on just clinging to those. So the clinging in this stage is to the sadhus, but the sadhus have this connection with Krishna going on, and so it comes to the point of clinging to or taking shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. And that's how bhakti begins, and is how it continues in the intermediate stages, up to the mature stage. So what you're doing, keep doing it. Do it attentively, and do it like consciously. This is how mercy of Krishna comes into one's life. And when who receives the mercy of Krishna, magic happens. I mean, things that we can't do on our own. By that, by magic, I mean that. If you try to go beyond your shortcomings or the complications of material existence, it's very much a struggle. Krishna says that in Bhagavad Gita. Devihyeshu gunamayi mama maya duratyaya. Very difficult, struggling against the material nature. But mama ivaye prapadyante maya mitam tarantite. Those that take shelter of me can easily cross beyond it. Just, it's magic. It's mystical. It's the power of bhakti. Welcome. Come on in. Close the door. Hare Krishna. So that's a little sharing. See if there's any comments or something, questions on this or anything at all you want to discuss. It's 8:15.
You said that in the pyramid we have like different kinds of humans, right?
Yes.
So every layer by layer, the number of people who are devoted to the Lord will decrease. So what my question is, like, so there are other species also in the pyramid. Right?
Yes, that's correct.
So, like, are there levels in other species?
Yes.
Also?
Yes. The, according to the modes of nature, they're pervasive, ubiquitous. The modes of nature are operating on everything. And so there are, for example, there's trees and plants under the influence of different modes of nature, like poisonous plants or plants that don't bear edible fruits and flowers. And there are plants that bear edible fruits and flowers. Ignorance, passion, and goodness, and so on. Animal species, and so on. They're also under the, so there's different gradations, higher and lower, amongst the other species. And they're symptoms of consciousness, because consciousness is moved by guna and karma, quality and work. So according to previous karma and previous the modes of nature with which a soul has associated, they'll receive a body in a particular species influenced by a particular mode of nature and a certain karma to fulfill. There's gradations in terms of consciousness. Reflected in, one of the ways it's reflected is in the modes of nature.
Question I had in mind is, like, whenever a soul has a decision to make, whenever we have a decision to make.
We're speaking of humans now, right?
Yes, any soul.
Well, any soul means dogs and cats and fish and, you know.
I mean, considering anybody. Any
humans. We're talking of humans and making a decision? Qualify
yes,
it.
Yes.
Okay.
So, by humans, I mean. A soul has different bodies, right?
Yes.
So when a soul has to make a decision,
yeah,
maybe we can say for this case in human form. So we have, do we always have a choice, or it is somehow predetermined by the previous karma?
There's both. Both are operative. always free will is operative. And always the modes of nature and previous karma are operative. Even modes of nature and previous karma are operative, we still have free will. So, just take myself for an example. If I had not contacted a devotee and then taken up a life of devotion to Krishna, my life would look different. But guna and karma were acting, but that has changed. Now, I still have a certain nature, as we all do. And my nature, I've thought about this often, but my nature is, you know, if I weren't a devotee, I was headed for either one of two things. Primarily being a doctor, but then also maybe teaching medicine, because it's just my nature. So, I'm doing something else like that according to my nature, but you know, the field of activity is very different. And certainly my karma has changed. But there's qualities that are there. And it's perfectly okay. We use that in Krishna service. Okay. So, here's another way to say basically the same thing. Supposing according to, you know, palmistry or astrology, such and such is, you know, your destiny. Prabhupada said, we don't so much value astrologers or palmists. We go to kirtan and clap our hands and the lines in our hands change. You follow? The destiny may change just by taking up activity or a life of devotion to Krishna. Destiny changes. It's not that I was destined to do what I'm doing now. That's not correct understanding. By good fortune, I'm doing what I'm doing now. If that good fortune hadn't been there, destiny would have prevailed. I would have become whatever and had the good fortune, ill fortune according to guna and karma. It changed. For any of us, we can change our destiny.
I mean, my understanding was, like, if we are, for example, if we are involved in Krishna service, maybe that's because in previous karma we have...
No, it's not karma created. Excuse me for cutting you off like that. Something material can't create something spiritual.
Okay. So maybe I was thinking, like, because of the previous karma, we are engaged in the service of God.
No. Incorrect. That's you got an F for that answer. It's not. It's because the logic is, if it were so, then all pious people would be devotees, but they're not. And all impious people, but you know, like Prahlad Maharaj was the son of Hiranyakashipu, and he was a great devotee. So it was good fortune. While he was still within the womb of his mother, Narada understood this soul is very special, and he spoke spiritual topics to his mother, heard by the child, still within the womb, and he became Prahlad. His destiny changed, not because of previous pious activities, but the intervention of Narada. Or like Muchukunda, he was saying my path was like this, and then Garga, and now it's something else. So it's another principle than piety or good karma. It's descending mercy. It's another principle. Yes.
I mean, in the whole talk that you were talking about devotion, and I mean, I just wanted to know if life of devotion, I mean, is it a metaphor that, I mean, we are sowing the seeds of devotion and giving up our life for Krishna, is it just a metaphor or we actually want, it can only be achieved through real practice? What I mean to say is, did the character in the story, did he necessarily have to stay in a cave and
pray? No, 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 no. Look,
Yeah. So I'm coming back to this, about yourself, that you said that you were on your way of becoming a doctor. I mean, what if that was, instead of being devoted,
I could have become a devotee doctor. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
sure, no problem.
By serving people and...
sure, no problem.
That would have been
no problem. Yeah. Okay? No problem. It's just, there was a juncture where, this is like a long story, but I took a leave of absence from my education process, a little time out, because I wanted to, there was many things, but I didn't want to be on the conveyor belt, at the end of the conveyor belt, and not have a clue. Like, who am I, the purpose of life, what's going on? I saw that happening in lives of others, and I didn't want to be in that position. So, it was this decision that I made. It didn't have to be done the way that I did it, but it's what I did. I took a time out so I could, get an answer to those questions that people are too busy to ask. Pressured by, deadlines and schedules and expectations and, So I did a timeout. And of the timeout, one of the timeout things I did was search different things, and I came across this, and I thought, well, this is nice, let me spend some time in an ashram. It wasn't like I'm going to do this forever. But I don't want to examine it from the outside looking in. Bhaktisiddhanta, I heard, gave this example. If you want to know what the taste of honey is, you have to open the jar and stick your finger in. You can't just look at it and figure it out from the outside. That's what the taste of honey is. You have to go inside. Common sense. Let me just finish. Let me finish. So it was my decision. So I decided let me enter an ashram for some time and experience that. The gift that Prabhupada wanted to provide. And then after some time I'll decide what I want to do after that. Maybe I don't even want to continue with this, I don't know. It's just, I'll do this for a while, it makes sense to me. So, after a while, a few years passed, and I thought, okay, now I know what that was, I feel my life has greatly been enriched. Now, do I want to go back and complete my medical studies? Now, it could have been done in a different way, but that was, what I did. And I thought, I certainly could be a devotee doctor, that would be a nice way to serve. As was the intention when I decided or chose medical career. And I thought, well, there's lots of doctors and not so many devotees. And maybe by being a devotee, I could help make doctors devotees. And it'd be a little more difficult to do that being a doctor because my hands would be tied with lots of stuff. But I could help people in that other way. So it's just, anyway, I'm very happy. I'm not at all unhappy. I like very much. And I can do lots of service. I have lots and lots and lots and lots of discretionary time to do lots of things that are like this. So I'll just continue. But no, I didn't have to have taken that time out. So like any of you, it's not recommending that's what you guys should do. Continue in your, but put bhakti in the center. That's driving instead of the other one. Get the degree so I can get the position so I can get the comfortable life, and live that way. But put bhakti in the center, and then the purpose becomes different, and the satisfaction is something else. That's more the message. In fact, it's exactly the message of Bhagavad Gita. But it's what suits somebody. We each have different natures, and this suits my nature. And it could easily have been just continue in the medical study and cultivate bhakti inwardly and, join the Krishna house and, do it that in the association of devotees. Especially here, you have that facility. Fantastic. It's not... this is better than that, or that's better than this. It's develop bhakti, whether it's this or that way, according to one's nature. Does that help? Does that address your question?
Yeah.
Not exactly.
So I read Bhagavad Gita. I was just comparing what Krishna taught Arjuna when he was trying to run away from the.
Stay in your position. That was what he told Arjuna.
He said, "Yeah, that's your path. That's your duty, and part of your karma is to fight these people out."
That is karma. That is karma. His duty.
Duty. Yeah. So I mean, when we are on a path and we are devoted, so fulfilling our duties is also sometimes
perfect.
Becomes a part
perfect.
Of
and there's another perfect. In addition to that perfect, it's not like this one is better than that one.
Definitely.
Okay, but for some persons, doing what I have done. Suits them. It suits my nature. I like it. And it's also dharma. There are verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam that says one who does like that should not think that they're transgressing their dharma by doing that. One who devotes himself in a theistic way exclusively to Krishna service, they're not transgressing their dharma. They're performing it in a higher way or a different way. So it's not to say that others that don't do that they're in the doghouse or something. They're like inferior. It's the essence is the essence, not the form is the essence. Yeah, that which suits us is the way to go. And whether it's the way that you're describing or the way that my life unfolded, the essence is the hearing and chanting and the dedicating of things to Krishna. Whatever the things are, the gift of intelligence that has been given to you, or your health, or your ability, or your compassion, or whatever it is that you have that makes up you. It's a gift, and use that. In devotion, so receive some training how to use that as service to Krishna, as an offering unto him, because it came from him. And recognizing that, awakening devotion, make that offering in your life. Fantastic. 100% perfect. Something else? Yes?
I was just thinking about Guna. Are people associated with guna the time they are born and can't change it? Is it like that?
Can guna be changed from our time of birth? Is that your question? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I'm supposing somebody has an anger problem. You know any people that have an anger problem?
Yeah.
Okay, so where does anger come from? According to Bhagavad Gita, anger comes from unfulfilled desires. Kamesha, Krodesha. Kama, lust. Kroda, anger. Where does Kama come from? Rajoguna, mode of passion. So when we associate with the mode of passion, intense longing and desire, mode of passion. And when that expectation isn't fulfilled, we become frustrated and angry. So persons who exhibit anger, that's where it's coming from. It's the mode of ignorance that has the same source as the mode of passion. It's the younger brother having the same mother. The mother is contact with passion. Comes anger. So that's the problem. Now what to do? Change the channel to the mode of goodness. Is it possible? Yes. A person with an anger problem, from Bhagavad Gita's message, by cultivation, that is, association with those who are of the quality of goodness, then the quality of goodness can become their mode of nature instead of the passion and then anger, following passion one. It's possible. In fact, the whole of Vedic culture is to gradually elevate one gradually to the mode of goodness and then to the realm of transcendence. The bhakti process is saying, rather than go up the staircase, take the elevator. I mean, that's a metaphor, but immediately contact Krishna. He's the supreme pure, and that can relieve one of the contaminations of, for example, anger. And I could, you know, if we didn't have time constraints, I could give you examples of, I've seen it happen. I've also seen it not happen. But when it happens, it's because someone opens themselves to receiving this seed of bhakti and the sound vibration, and it changes them. Their guna, their mode of nature, becomes changed. It happens. Real life today kind of situations. There was an experiment. You want something?
Oh, you can go ahead.
Let me just quickly. At the University of Florida in Gainesville, there was a devotee who was doing his PhD in social sciences, and he decided that he it was granted by his PhD supervisor to do a study on the effect of chanting Hare Krishna on three things: tendencies for depression, the modes of nature. What was the third thing? Do you recall? Dear Govinda, tendency for depression, modes of nature, and I think stress. So, really quickly, here's what, with the statistics department overseeing everything that he was doing, he put an ad in the Gator Press saying, little ad, anybody, not special group of people, I'm doing my PhD, and you'll receive $35 if you assist me by doing this little experiment. Anyone that's interested, please contact us. So, you know, such and such. So anybody out there, random. And the interview process was to see two things. They'll report honestly, and they'll do it. That's all. And then they took the candidates in three groups. And they told them all the same thing. One group got the Hare Krishna mantra. Another group got another Vedic mantra. Another was the placebo group. Some gobbledygook syllables they just made up. But they told them the same thing. And the message was, this is a very special ancient system. They didn't even say India or Vedic. It's just like a sound vibration, a sacred sound vibration mantra that is very effective. It's known specifically to be effective in these three things: relieving depression, tendencies towards stress, and the modes of nature. They don't know what the modes of nature are. But, you know, so what your assignment is every day for 3 months, for some period of time, you say this mantra, like 15 minutes every morning. And then, you know, there's self-evaluation, and then there's the professor evaluation, and there's the candidate for his PhD evaluation. So three different ways of evaluating. And long story short, the paper, the results showed that the Hare Krishna mantra had the greatest effect in relieving people from the influence of the lower modes of nature, from tendencies for stress and tendencies for depression. So, you know, overseen by the statistics department, make sure there wasn't fudging or, you know, something. So yes, one's quality can change by spiritual contact. Even people that, you know, they're not necessarily spiritual people. They wanted $35 and they found it was interesting. So they did it. That address your question?
Yes.
Yeah. You had something?
Is there a difference between the Vedic definition of species and the modern?
I'm sure. I don't know what that is, though. I don't know what it is. Somebody that's a biologist maybe can answer your question better than me. But I don't. I'm sure there is some difference, but I don't know. I'm sorry. I can't help you with that one. You have some thoughts on it?
Well, specifically, what I think the modern definition of species is that animal A can reproduce with animal B when they're of the same species, Well, then, like, say in Madagascar, you have many different species of lemurs. And some lemurs can't reproduce with other lemurs. So, according to the Vedic definition, would they be of the same species and of the same consciousness?
Haven't a clue. But there are a person I could refer you to that might is Drutakarma. But he might not also. But he spent a lot of time with, you know, this topic. And Devaprastha can help you get his contact information. And he'll reply, even if he doesn't know you from anybody. He's a gentleman and he'll reply, you know, I don't know, or here's a book you can read, or here's how much I do know. He'll reply. Drutakarma. Someone else? Yes.
Krishna, please accept me.
Hi, Krishna.
I have a question about how bhakti starts.
Ah.
You mentioned in contact with sadhus.
Yep.
The example of molten gold spilling over.
Yeah.
How is it that some people, when they come in contact with sadhus, something changes in their heart, but others, nothing happens? Is there a prerequisite that's required for this rebirth? Is there a basic...
Beautiful question. Yes. Here's... three things. One thing is, those who are very attached, it makes it more difficult. And there are those that are less attached, and then therefore it's, the movement is more quick. Can you just tilt? Yeah, good, perfect. So, there's a story of, the question you asked was asked by someone of our spiritual master's spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta. And the setting was they were in Vrindavan, going and visiting the holy places of Vrindavan for 1 month, and every evening he would have some discussion, and someone asked that question. Why is it that we see one dances and the other doesn't? And he answered by giving a story. By this story you can understand my answer. He said there's a wedding party, and the party of the groom, the man to be married to the girl, they were going to travel by boat to the girl's home at night, and in the morning, you know, have the wedding, because that's the Vedic tradition. So they got in a boat and paid the boatman, and good fortune, tomorrow our son is going to be married, and they settled to take rest in the boat in a very happy mood. And they took rest, and in the morning, the sun is rising, today is the day of the wedding, and they looked around and they saw they're in the same place. And they got really upset and got on the case of the boatman. What did you do? You were sleeping all night long. We're supposed to, the wedding is this morning. He said, no, I was rowing all night, I swear to you, I promise. And they looked and they saw the anchor was still in. And that's the end of the story. When one maintains attachments, progress is minimal or slowed down. And then, so what is being detached? This is a nice topic. It's a nice big topic. But being detached means, Krishna says in the 5th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, being attached to him is really what detachment means. Because monkeys, they're also detached. They live in the jungle, and they have no clothes, and they eat bananas, and you know. So, people may live like that kind of renunciation, and that's not complete. The complete form of renunciation is, whatever it is that one accepts, this is something in relation to the prior question about career development, which is that which you accept without attachment, anasaktasya vishayan, without attachment to sense enjoyment, yatarham upayunjitaha, as much as necessary, and dedicated to service to the Supreme. That's detachment. That's a complete sense of detachment, the verse says. So, those that have that, to degree one has that, one can advance. Now, I said there was a few things. Prior association, some persons, like say their spiritual trajectory is here, and someone else is here from their previous life or whatever. So when they get some association, the one that's here doesn't, you know, can go only this far, and then the rest is, you know, little struggle, and the other one right away is up there, because in previous life they've done other, their spiritual progress has advanced further. So that's another explanation of why we might see someone move quickly and another person not. And the third is, it's a detail, but it's nice. Another one of our acharyas named Jiva Goswami says that even to get, like the Muchukunda got the association of Garga, or we, each of us, have gotten some association somewhere. Prior to that, there's some unknowing association. So that's another factor. Unknowingly, somewhere back there, something happened where we, you know, some good fortune came, some causeless good fortune came, and here we are. Like, you know, a lot of the persons in this room are from India. And there's a few of us that aren't. And to be born in India, according to Lord Chaitanya's teachings, that's good fortune. It indicates some past good fortune, some past piety, just to take birth in India. Because from birth you're hearing things that I didn't hear till I was 20 years old. I never heard Krishna's name before. And I didn't know how to pronounce Bhagavad Gita.
Sorry to interject.
Huh?
Sorry to interject, but I think the reason why you did birth in a
Western
body to explain spirituality to the West.
Well, I have another, maybe, but I have another perspective that Krishna made arrangement for Prabhupada to come, and some persons who had previously taken up devotional service were there to assist him. That's my perspective. Because, and I say that from practical experience, when I first did hear Krishna's, the chanting of Krishna's name, it wasn't even from devotees. It was from non-devotees. It was the Broadway musical Hair where they chanted Hare Krishna. And I used to go to the music room and Norton Student Union and go listen to that, just that one song over and over again, even before I met devotees, because I was attracted. That attraction, now I understand, then I didn't. There was some prior contact. So maybe, as you say, you know, to deliver this message to other people of similar, but here we are, you know, University of Maryland, and look around the room. A lot of people from India here. So, to assist, because Prabhupada came to the West, specifically came to America, so many, but then he went to Europe, and so many in Europe, who, my sense is, some prior devotion to Krishna, to assist this great devotee, Srila Prabhupada, and his mission. And maybe, you know, so to help in Europe and to help in America and help in Australia and in Africa and other such places. Maybe you're saying the same thing. We're saying the same thing. But it's good, at the same time, it's good fortune. Here's the example from the Bhagavatam. In order to ignite fire, supposing you have dry wood, In order to ignite dry wood, you first have to make it dry. Excuse me, wet wood. You have to make it dry. And so we were like wet wood. And it was a challenge to make the wet wood into dry wood before the dry wood could ignite. Now it's becoming kind of homogenized. Meaning, you know, the bad habits of Western culture are being exported throughout the world. Right? You follow what I'm saying? Are you with me? I'm looking at you. Yes. Okay. Anything else? Prashadam time? It's 9:10. Okay. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Thank you very much.